From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm April Baer. Today, a major Michigan-based adoption agency decides to open up to working with LGBTQ couples.
By, you know, discriminating against a particular class of people, one that is more likely to adopt, you're limiting the number of kids that can find forever homes.
We'll talk with Attorney General Dana Nessel, who's spent years fighting for LGBTQ families. Then, artist Elizabeth Youngblood on how learning to weave inspired her work in other disciplines like drawing and sculpture.
If I hadn't been a designer, I think I could have settled in as a weaver for a really long time.
And some historical perspective on the redistricting process.
After the 2000 and 2010 censuses, it was all Republican controlled, and it was pretty brutal. I mean, they made no secret of the fact of what they were going to do.
Those stories coming up. Welcome to Stateside. I'm April Baer. The redistricting process is coming to a simmer in Lansing. Today, we're going to look at how Michigan ended up with the representation that we have today.
Democrats wanted a one-man, one-vote situation, and the Republicans wanted a situation that would still involve a formula that looked at, for one thing, land, territory, boundaries, and population.
That's coming up later in the show, but first, a Michigan-based adoption network that is one of the largest in the United States has made an about-face on a long dispute over who gets to parent. Bethany Christian Services says it will begin providing help to LGBTQ families, reversing its earlier policies, starting right now. The issue goes back to a conflict over Bethany's contract to provide adoption and foster care services. It was one of several key cases around the country that challenged faith-based organizations to work with queer families if they want to work with the states. With us today is Michigan's Attorney General Dana Nessel, who had an important role at several stages of this issue. Dana Nessel, welcome back to Stateside.
Thanks again for having me.
Were you much surprised to hear of Bethany's reversal in its national policy?
Actually, I wasn't, because it seemed as though they were transferring towards that policy in Michigan quite some time ago. And, you know, this is just anecdotal, but what I had heard through the grapevine is that in part the reason for doing this was because so many of the social workers that worked with Bethany really wanted to see this happen, because they wanted to make sure that these children that they were placing into foster homes or into adoptive homes had as many choices as possible, or the availability of qualified parents. And by, you know, discriminating against a particular class of people, one that is more likely to adopt, frankly, than any other class of individuals, you're minimizing or you're limiting the number of kids that can find forever homes. And if you're a social worker trying to place kids, then that's antithetical to your goals and your mission.
Early in your term as Michigan's Attorney General, you settled a lawsuit against the state that involved some adoption agencies and foster care agencies that included Bethany Christian Services. Can you just give us a brief background about what was going on in that case?
Well, you know, there was a lawsuit that had been filed by the ACLU, and it really had to do with policies that were being utilized by these agencies that, you know, in essence, I would say permitted them, or that they were behaving in a way where they were turning away same-sex couples and LGBTQ individuals that were otherwise qualified to be foster care parents or to be adoptive parents. And these agencies, again, state-funded, had all signed agreements with the state with non-discrimination clauses. And it was the opinion of the state and the Department of Health and Human Services that they were actually violating those contracts that they had already entered.
And the reason I bring this up is it's sort of one of the root disputes in Bethany's evolution on its national policies on this. That case was settled with several stipulations. It said that Michigan needed to take action to make sure that LGBTQ couples were treated equitably. But the settlement also gave the state some latitude, as I understand it, in sort of when it chooses to act. Are there still religious-affiliated adoption agencies working with the state that might deny service to LGBTQ parents? You know, Bethany is a big player, but it's not the only one in the industry.
Right. Well, I should, you know, indicate that there is an ongoing lawsuit that was filed after that settlement, basically challenging it on constitutional grounds. So that is, while that case is being decided at the United States Supreme Court relative to this issue. So, you know, we will wait and see what that decision is. Obviously, it's expected by the end of the term. And the question, of course, is whether or not a state-funded adoption agency, one that accepts state dollars and deals with wards of the state, these are not private adoptions, these are public adoptions, whether or not you can take state money and then still discriminate against certain groups of people when the state has told you that you are, you know, that's not acceptable. But I think this really speaks to, and what's so important about what Bethany did here, it speaks to the greater issue. This is not about discriminating against LGBTQ people. It's not about discriminating against same-sex couples. It's about hurting the most vulnerable children in our society, children who have had their rights terminated of their biological parents and are wards of the state and are desperately in need of homes. And there are thousands and thousands of such children here in the state of Michigan. And we have so many people in our state that identify as LGBTQ. We have so many married same-sex couples that are desperate to adopt children. And statistically, we know that same-sex couples are far more likely to adopt from foster care than opposite-sex couples. And it's not just that, they're more likely to adopt otherwise hard-to-place children. So kids that are older or disabled, children of color. And, you know, to take parents that are otherwise qualified and have gone through this very rigorous test where they have to go through background checks and they have to take parenting classes and they have to, frankly, pay a lot of money. These are people who really want children and we know who are qualified to adopt and raise children. And to deny them the ability to adopt, it's not just that you're harming those people and you're using state tax dollars to discriminate. There are thousands of children that need good homes and are denied homes because these agencies, which are all throughout the state, refuse to work with these couples. And that's why agencies like Bethany, I think, have come to understand that the best way to do their jobs and to ensure that these children are placed into loving, safe, secure, forever homes is to open it up to all qualified parents and not discriminate.
Let's go back just a little bit further. Before you were Attorney General, you represented April DeBoer and Jane Rouse when they challenged Michigan's voter passed ban on same-sex marriage, a case that ultimately was decided by a Supreme Court precedent. And their case specifically involved their children. They wanted to adopt each other's children. What kind of precedents did that case set?
Well, firstly, let me say this. Oddly, that case seemed to pave the way for a law that specifically codified discrimination by state-funded adoption agencies against same-sex couples. And it was just before the Obergefell decision was decided in 2015, literally just a few weeks before, that the legislature and Governor Snyder quickly signed into law codification of discrimination by these agencies, which was already a practice that had been sort of ongoing, but it wasn't codified into law. Obviously, I was very disturbed about that. But, you know, I think that the Republicans who were in the legislature and Governor Snyder saw the writing on the wall and knew that it was likely we would win that case. But, you know, again, that case involved April DeBoer and Jane Rouse, an emergency room nurse and a NICU nurse, who had adopted five children from foster care, all of them, you know, special needs or who had great physical challenges and, you know, had raised them mostly since the day they were born and dropped off at the hospital where they worked and had great outcomes for those kids, and were by all respects deemed to be very, very good parents, so much so that the state did not challenge their parenting ability. And we know that the outcomes for children raised by same-sex couples are every bit as good as the children raised by opposite-sex couples. So there's no argument there. But, you know, I think that as much as things started to progress as time went on, there was an insidious backlash for those who wanted to use religion to discriminate against same-sex couples and LGBTQ people, even though we know that they had great success in raising children that, frankly, no one else wanted. And so we've gone back and forth and back and forth. Unfortunately, the United States Supreme Court is much more conservative than it was in 2015 when the Obergefell decision came down. And I'm very concerned that this new makeup of this United States Supreme Court will actually move us backwards and allow the furtherance of discrimination against LGBTQ people and same-sex couples and the children that they're raising based on, you know, closely held religious beliefs is really how it's phrased. But, you know, to me, what it really is, it's just discrimination. And it hurts, again, it hurts parents, it hurts children, and it hurts society.
I don't know how much time you have to keep up with folks you've represented, but do you know how April DeBoer and Jane Rouse and their kids are doing today?
Yeah, actually, I just talked to April the other day, and they're doing well. Their kids are thriving. You know, they're doing very well in school. I think they just moved recently to a new location, and they're doing well. They have the same struggles, of course, that everybody else has. And I'm sure their kids, you know, some of them had more pronounced special needs than others. And there are thousands and thousands of families just like theirs all around the state of Michigan. The thought of denying people like April and Jane children who didn't have homes and didn't have parents is quite honestly sickening to me. And I know that April and Jane went to agencies where they tried to adopt initially and were turned down. And, you know, there's no way to explain that. And there's no way to justify it.
Michigan Attorney General Dana Nessel, thank you so much for your time today.
Thanks for having me.
In just a moment, one Detroit artist talks about following the thread of a thought.
The process, you know, it's a thinking process for me. And so drawing those lines was also a matter of replicating a thought.
Elizabeth Youngblood on her practice and her solo show of engrossing drawings. That's coming up in just a minute. We'll be right back. This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. What's left to do after you've conquered a whole range of artistic mediums, from drawing to ceramics, from fiber art to sculpture? When you've made your mark in New York City as a sought-after graphic designer and mentored hundreds of art students on the East Coast and in Michigan? For artist Elizabeth Youngblood, the answer seems to be follow the thread of your thoughts. She has a new solo show of work at M Contemporary Gallery in Ferndale. The exhibition's called Brimtone. And she's with us now. Elizabeth Youngblood, welcome to Stateside.
Thank you very much for having me here.
You've done several series of drawings, some of which we see in this exhibition, in which you follow one line, almost as one follows the thread of a thought. And the line takes on a shape and ultimately a surface. And some eventually, I guess, take on almost three dimensions, a built shape. How did this process start for you of drawing in this way?
Well, it came from weaving. I also weave. And I don't know if you've ever seen a warp prepared. You know how you wind a warp on a warping mill or a warping board?
Could you describe?
Well, it's a series of pegs, and warping board is a series of pegs. Imagine a frame, maybe built out of 1x2. And then there are pegs all along the top and the bottom and along the sides. And say you want a warp that's 5 yards long. You wind a thread back and forth across the pegs until you get 5 yards. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
And if you have a warping mill, it's the same thing, except it spins, and it's like a big cube, and there are pegs all along the four sides and the top and bottom. You simply wind your thread or across as many pegs as it takes to give you the length that you want.
So the line drawing replicates that winding motion.
It actually is the second step, because after you've wound your warp, say you've wound 100 ends of, 100 repetitions of the thread, and then you have to take it off and control it until you can get it onto the loom so it doesn't get tangled. And the way that you do that, it's called chaining up a warp. You make a loop and then you reach through, and it's almost like crocheting. That's actually what it's like. It's that motion where you reach through a loop and you pull your thread back through the loop, and then you reach through that loop and pull the thread back through again. Only this time you're pulling through the wound ends. They're called ends. Every thread is called an end of your applied to the loom warp. And so that way, if you drop it or something, it doesn't turn into a tangled mess.
So the motion that your hand goes through as you're working on these drawings, calling back to the winding, it's easy to imagine this, starting as a small movement and growing larger. Is that how it works?
Well, it was sort of the beauty of the warp, because the ends, if you think of the threads as lines, those lines are then controlled. They're all in order. So they really came from trying to figure out how I could replicate what I considered to be the beauty of a chained-up warp. And that also related to the process. It's a thinking process for me. And so drawing those lines was also a matter of replicating a thought. That was the intention initially, was to try to repeat the same line, which, of course, is impossible to do. And that's also a metaphor for the way you change from one day to another. And it also ties to the weaving metaphor again, because you are building a surface. When you're weaving, you're building a plane of cloth. And when I'm drawing these lines, I'm building a plane again, which is the shape. But they're all related. And then, of course, I was a graphic designer, too, and I did a lot of typography. And again, it's a similar situation.
Can you tell us a little bit about what's going on in your mind when you're working on these pieces, whether they're weavings or the drawings? Are you in a thought process, or is it more sort of a liminal state where thought kind of suspends for a while?
For the line drawings, they start as a thought, and then it moves into a more liminal space. I get interested in the form. There will be something that my hand will do. Sometimes there'll be there'll be something under the paper, so the line, I hit that thing under the paper so the line isn't as straight and there's a wiggle in it. Or when you see many lines that are basically parallel and then all of a sudden one goes off to the side, I think of that as a thought wandering. Or it changes from a solid line to a series of tiny little dots. Again, that's a thought changing, or my mind wandering off to something else. When I'm weaving, unless I'm really just weaving fabric, I'm kind of paying attention. I'm paying attention to the edges. But when you're weaving yardage, it does become something that's very physical. It's kind of like a dance, because it's all rhythm. You're stepping on a treadle. You have to make sure you're stepping on the right treadle, but you kind of line them up in a way that makes sense. And then once you get going, it's all kind of muscle memory, and it's really kind of meditative. But if I'm weaving something kind of more experimental, I have to pay attention.
This exhibition is called Room Tone. And folks who've ever been on a film set or done video production know that room tone is when you freeze everything for 90 seconds or more, just sort of stop people from moving or speaking, and record the sounds of a room with nobody in motion. And it's used in the editing process to provide background sound or some continuity. Why did you choose that title?
Oh, just because when I learned what it was, I thought, this is perfect. Because, a room tone is a reading. It's a reading of the room. It's a reading of the room with all the people in place, with all the furniture in place, and it's from a very specific location in the room. And if you moved the recording equipment to another place in the room tone would be different. So it's unique. And I considered these drawings and the way that they're related to thought, or the way that they're at least based in thought and in process, I think of them as readings for, I can't come up with a better word for it. I've been trying to find a better word than mindscape. It's kind of a reading of what's going on in my head. Mm-hmm. And I really like the metaphor because of the specificity of what room tone is for each location that it's taken from or taken within.
What does it mean to have the time to follow a thought through in that way? Is that something that you've always been able to make time to do?
I think the short answer is no. I was very impatient as a young person. I couldn't imagine weaving, just dressing a loom, you know, pulling each thread through two different stages. You know, and you have hundreds of threads sometimes. I just couldn't imagine doing it. First time I ever wove was in high school, and I only had 8 ends per inch. You know, and the thing was only 10 inches wide, but the thought of handling 100 ends just made me nuts. So no, I haven't always been that way. I've really gained a lot of patience as I've aged, and it does take some doing. I have to be in the right mood to sit down and do that work. I call it butt in the chair time. I really do have to sometimes just take myself by the collar and sit down and work. But, you know, I've kind of always been that way. But now I can just sit there for hours. You know, I could sit there for a long time and do it. And I watched it in my students, too. They need a break. If we have classes an hour and a half, they need a break in between. I remember when it struck me how I used to need a break, too, for if an hour and an hour or an hour and a half session was going to happen. And, you know, as I matured, I mean, I could work all day without a break, you know. So that is something that came to me over time.
If you're just joining in, I'm speaking with Detroit artist Elizabeth Youngblood. She has a solo exhibition titled Room Tone that's currently on display at M Contemporary Art in Ferndale. You're so versed in so many different disciplines. Like we mentioned, you had this successful career as a graphic designer. And early in your education, you were very active with ceramics. And you've done ink and bookmaking, lots of printed disciplines. But it's clear that weaving is pretty key. Could you talk a little bit about why weaving became important to you?
Well, I grew up sewing. I'm of an age where just about everybody learned to sew. I mean, you could make a skirt, you know, you could make a dress. Mm-hmm. And I come from a creative family. My aunt was a wonderful cook, and again, everybody knew how to sew, especially the generation beyond me. My mother made a lot of our clothes. She knitted. My uncle had a woodworking shop, and so I learned to, you know, run power tools and stuff with him. So in his workshop. So, you know, making stuff has always been of interest to me. I guess when I was at Cranbrook is where it really caught my interest because I saw people really doing interesting things on a loom. And then I remembered that one little piece that I did in high school. And here was a whole department. I took a minor, I guess, for a semester, and I remember Gail Rutter was her name. She was a student there who was a major in fiber. You know, the things that you can do with it, the fact that a loom is a machine, really, and that you have so much control over what the output is, because, you know, you have heddles and treadles, and you have all kinds of combinations. And the more heddles and the more treadles you have, and the more harnesses you have, the more intricate stuff you can do. You can weave more than one plane of cloth at a time. You can have them intersect, you know, horizontally and vertically, you know, weftwise and warpwise. So it's just fascinating. There's so many things you can do just that are functional. And then if you start to play around with it experimentally, you know, fool with tension and get, you know, two different warps at the same time on two different beams, you can play with tension and you can weave seersucker. I mean, that's what seersucker was. It's just two different tensions. And so it's just endlessly fascinating to me. If I hadn't been a designer, I think I could have settled in as a weaver for a really long time, but because I was making a living as a designer, I could, you know, only take classes, you know, in the summer. I'd take 2 weeks off or something and go to Penland or Haystack or something like that. But I think weaving is endlessly fascinating.
What's been pulling you toward drawing lately?
Probably time. I put a warp on, I don't know, a couple of months ago, and it was so dense that I really couldn't weave it. I had to undo a step. And I just haven't gotten back to it, and I keep threatening to do it. And then I have been, I've been kind of busy. This year started off with a bang, and I needed to do drawings, and I needed to focus my attention there. And I just haven't even redone that step on a loom, which, you know, most of it's been done. So it's really just a matter of button the chair time and saying, I'm going to focus here, not there. But it's hard because there are a couple problems I've been trying to solve with the drawings. And then as I've started to do them, I get new ideas. And I think, oh, maybe I can work out this problem this way, because I've been trying not to fix these drawings with regular fixative. And so then I go down another rabbit hole, and I just haven't gotten back to weaving. But I'm gonna soon.
You spent some time, as we mentioned, on the East Coast in your graphic design career, and you did work for places like the New York Times. And then, I want to say about 20 years ago, you came back to Detroit. What's it been like to make a life as a working artist here?
Oh, gee. I'm loving it. I really am. I just didn't know how to do it as a younger person. And I don't know whether I just didn't have the knowledge or whether we really didn't have the opportunity. And I think it's a little bit of both, because kids come out of graduate school now and even undergraduate school, and they can see the way. They're the galleries, you know, where they can start to show their work and they can, you know, begin to professionalize the way that it's presented, and there are residencies and things that you can go on. So I found it to be really terrific.
Well, just as you've had this sort of dual existence within graphic design and contemporary art, your work kind of straddles this line between fine art and studio craft, which in art circles, it seems like they've always had this sort of Oscar and Felix kind of relationship.
That's a good way to describe it.
Well, the art world sometimes hasn't had much use for craft, you know, as if people who focus on their craftsmanship somehow have less to say. Whereas the contemporary craft world finds the art world kind of exclusionary and maybe even lacking in some discipline. Have you felt a need to position yourself between these two poles in your work?
No, I guess I'm not successful enough to have had to, you know, wrestle with that one, but I know exactly what you're talking about. Personally, I mean, because I believe in craftsmanship and I understand a certain amount of rigor and discipline and knowing some things, and you have to know and follow certain things in, say, ceramics just to, you know, get it to hold together or not blow up or, you know, over fire or all kinds of things like that. And I have that skill. In fine art, for instance, I'm not a painter. I don't know the craft of painting. You know, with oil painting, you put on thicker and thinner layers, you know, in various orders, and, you know, there's ways to thin your oils and so forth, your paints. And see, I don't know any of that. So I feel like I can't be a painter. But my drawing and stuff, I'm kind of in the experimental side of that. So rigor isn't, you know, the draftsmanship, for instance, isn't real important in what I do in terms of drawing. And I guess I would be hard-pressed to do a wonderful portrait of you, because figurative work is so prominent and having such a wonderful kind of resurgence here in Detroit. I wouldn't be able to do that. So I am happy kind of in the abstract mode for my fine art, for the drawings. And in ceramics, where I do know the rules, and a lot of the rules for weaving, I like to kind of push those and see how far I can, you know, how thin can I get this porcelain without it falling apart? You know, how much, because, you know, you don't mix different clay bodies and so forth for various reasons. Because when you do, you know, they shrink at different rates and so forth, and they don't hold together. Well, I'm real interested in putting them together and seeing how far I can get away with that. So, again, where there are the rules and I know the rules, I want to push them. And where I don't know the rules, that's okay, because I want to work in a more experimental way anyhow.
Well, Elizabeth Youngblood, it's been such a pleasure to talk to you. Thanks for taking a few minutes to tell us about your work.
Well, thank you for your interest. You have no idea how much it means when people are interested in what you do.
Elizabeth Youngblood's show, Room Tone, is on view at M Contemporary Art Gallery in Ferndale until March 20th. Coming up, Northern Michigan Congressman Jack Bergman is quite popular within his district, but the recent divide in the GOP has ignited disputes up north about how he represents Republican values. More on that story coming up in just a moment. Stay with us. You're listening to Stateside. I'm April Baer. A recent meeting of the Grand Traverse County Board got pretty tense after Congressman Jack Bergman joined in. He's a Republican representing Northern Michigan and the Upper Peninsula in the House of Representatives. A resolution praising Bergman failed to pass after many residents called in to say that they did not support him. But this former military man has won three elections by growing margins. Interlochen Public Radio's Max Johnston reports that Congressman Bergman plans on being in office for the foreseeable future.
The Grand Traverse County Board's last meeting opened with Jack Bergman calling from his car.
Good morning, everyone, and thank you for allowing me to join you, because God blesses us all every day with that 24 hours, and it's up to us to figure out how to use those 24 hours.
Bergman recited the Pledge of Allegiance and a Bible passage before signing off. The congressman was one of the main topics of the meeting, specifically his stance on the 2020 election. Congressman Bergman voted against certifying President Joe Biden's victory, even after the insurrection attempt. During public comment, Richard Walter said Bergman should resign.
He should not be praised and should not be honored by a frivolous resolution that does nothing to help this community.
A few of Bergman's supporters called in to repeat baseless or debunked claims of voter fraud. Here's Heather Cerrone, who ran for a state House seat last year.
And Congressman Bergman is representing the majority of the people in our district. The election was fraudulent.
Jack Bergman says he did not want to overturn the election results, but did want a federal commission to audit them.
People in Michigan and people in my district wanted to know that when they voted, that their vote was fairly counted. It was accurately counted. And if you weren't supposed to vote, you weren't, you know, your vote wasn't counted.
States, including Michigan, did post-election audits before results were certified. Jack Bergman was born and raised near Minneapolis, but started vacationing in Michigan's Upper Peninsula in the 80s. His career was split between the Marine Corps and the private sector. When the UP's congressional seat opened up, he thought about running. But Jack Bergman was unknown in northern Michigan.
Sure, go ahead. Who's going to vote for you? Nobody knows you.
That outsider status helped get Bergman the job. In 2016, he beat two former state senators, Tom Casperson and Jason Allen, in the primary. In the general last year, he got over 60% of the vote. Jack Bergman is very popular among Republicans in northern Michigan, like Cam Williams. She works for the Grand Traverse County GOP. Williams says she likes Bergman's staunchly conservative politics and anti-abortion stance.
He's concerned about the same things that I am.
But most important to her is Bergman's military background. Williams' husband and father both served. She believes Bergman knows how to clean up bureaucracy at the VA.
He's been in the military. He knows the red tape that there is in the military. So he's just trying to make that easier for veterans.
She occasionally calls his office to get his stance on an issue. Williams says if she can't get Congressman Bergman himself,
I can get a hold of someone to tell me something.
But Jack Bergman is an elusive figure to others in his district. Amy Hierstedt is a veteran and also comes from a military family. But to her, Congressman Bergman still feels like an outsider.
You know, I don't actually hear too many people talking about him here.
Hierstedt teaches political science at Lake Superior State in Sault Ste. Marie. She said she's called Bergman's office, but has never talked to the lawmaker himself, and that her voicemails often go unanswered. And she adds she doesn't see Jack Bergman having town halls or coffee hours like other lawmakers.
And so it's like he strategically just comes and goes as fast as he can and really doesn't have any desire to talk with his constituents.
Bergman had an empty calendar on his website that now redirects to the homepage. Constituents can request meetings with him. A rep for the congressman says they promote his events with press releases and newsletters. IPR combed through every one we've received since the new year. We found no announcements of public availability ahead of time. It's similar on social media. The congressman will often post a picture after an event, like a visit to Elk Rapids High School in February. Amy Hierstedt says she only sees Jack Bergman at one spot.
The only thing our elected will come to is the Sioux Locks and acts like it's his personal project when really we know this has been decades in the works.
As of February, Congressman Bergman had 24 bills signed into law. Most were on veterans issues. That productivity is similar to other Republicans he was elected with in 2016. Jack Bergman dismisses 90% of his critics as partisan.
Well, I think you should ask the people when they say that, ask them, by the way, did you vote for him? Let's face it, that is rhetoric meant to poison people's opinion, and I would suggest to you it's from the left.
Bergman says he's been there. He met with the Traverse City-based progressive group several times through 2019. Otherwise, he blames his constituents for his unavailability. He points to tense town halls during his first term to say that some don't want to talk. Here's a bit from one in Escanaba in 2017.
No, I have to tell you. Hang on, gang. Hang on. If you want to hear me talk, that's fine. If you don't, I mean, you can keep on talking, and then I'll just sit here quietly until you're ready to have me talk. I mean, I love to do that because I want to hear you, but we have to have the exchange.
Bergman says he wants to host more events with constituents post-COVID, with a caveat.
But if they want to do the things that they did after the 2016 election, you know, that's middle school behavior.
As for the complaints he says aren't partisan, Jack Bergman blames the district's size.
People who are really paying attention to where I am, they know that if I'm up in Houghton on Tuesday, there's probably a pretty good chance I'm not going to be in Traverse City on Wednesday.
Bergman's district is big. With 32 counties, it's the second biggest east of the Mississippi. Bart Stupak held the seat while it was gerrymandered three times. But the Democrats stayed in office for nearly 20 years. His secret?
Stay in contact with constituents was my number one priority.
He says the first congressional is a Republican district that he won by talking face-to-face with voters. But he says that kind of politics may be extinct. The constant travel eventually kept him from seeking re-election. And he doesn't think politicians have that dialogue with constituents now. Stupak says too many lawmakers avoid the heat, and constituents are constantly battling misinformation.
It's a difficult time. We're bitterly divided as a nation. But that's when I think you need your elected officials out there more, trying to bridge those gaps.
Stupak says a Democrat could win the first congressional again, but adds that would require the party to care about the rural district and finding the right candidate. In the meantime, Congressman Jack Bergman says he's not going anywhere.
And oh, by the way, in case anybody's wondering, yes, I am going to run again in 2022. And probably 2024, and who knows, 2026 and beyond.
I'm Max Johnston.
We've talked so much over the past couple of years about the ways in which gerrymandering has affected our political processes, deepening partisan divides. In recent weeks, the Independent Commission voters approved to do Michigan's next round of legislative redistricting has hit some speed bumps. They have to do with the timing of its work and funding. As we talk more about what's going on with the commission, it might be helpful to remember how Michigan got the representation we have today and why some think it should be different. Here to jog our collective memory is longtime Lansing political reporter, now retired from his role as publisher of Gongwer News Service. It's John Lindstrom. John, welcome back.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So if we imagine what redistricting used to look like, I'm going to paint a picture of lawmakers sitting as they would in any other legislative committee, maps of the state flanking the dais, and a stream of high-powered Congress members testifying, pleading the case for the district lines that they feel should be drawn. Am I getting warmer here? Is this close to it?
Oh, the dreams of youth. No, it... The thing about redistricting, not just in Michigan, but nationwide, for a long time was tied as much to land as it was to the number of people that lived in an area. All four of Michigan's constitutions, going back to 1835, make a specific reference to how you apportion on the basis of county boundaries or local boundaries. So the last constitution that was developed in this state, the 1963 constitution, it went swimmingly. That was probably the least contentious constitutional convention of any constitutional convention in the history of this country. Even things like the ban on the death penalty got tossed up, and almost everyone voted for it, Democrats and Republicans, until they came to the issue of redistricting. And then it all fell apart. And that was because the Democrats wanted a one-man, one-vote situation, and the Republicans wanted a situation that would still involve a formula that looked at, for one thing, land, territory, boundaries, and population.
And, well, why can you unpack why land would have been important to the Republicans making this argument at the time?
All I can think of is that the idea was is that you wanted to make sure that people were represented from their areas, which makes sense in large measure. And actually, to a degree, we still have a provision for considering boundaries, even in the 2018 proposal that voters, not politicians, passed. There is a requirement that they still look at as much as possible compactness and contiguous lines, which was part of the Bernie Apel standards that were enacted in the 1982 Supreme Court case in Michigan, which threw out the 1963 constitutional provisions. In 1963, what they did is they created a commission that consisted of two Republicans and two Democrats, and they were supposed to come up with the lines. And you know, you had all kinds of wacky proposals. There was one chap I remember who came in quite serious with a proposal that every single representative and every single senator would represent a portion of the entire state. And he was going to do that by a demarcation line that started right at Woodward and Jefferson in Detroit, and then extended out big pie wedges all the way across the state. If you can imagine, thank God they didn't enact that. But, The Constitution, however, did not make a provision for one man, one vote. And that was a decision made by the U.S. Supreme Court, in which they said you have to look at actual populations. Because otherwise, if you do it just on the basis of the territories, then you've debased the votes of various people. I mean, you could have an area that, say, has lost a lot of population and still would, say, be entitled to get two or three representatives, whereas an area that's gained a lot of population is only entitled to get one. And so that's inherently unfair. In effect, what we've been doing is going to a system that theoretically is more fair. Now, in 1982, the Supreme Court here in Michigan said the people can come up with a redistricting idea if they want to. Well, they didn't bother to get around to that for 36 years. And so that left it up to the legislature. And because for the last three redistricting cycles, it has been largely a Republican-controlled state government. And so they were the ones crafting the lines. After the 2000 and 2010 censuses, it was all Republican-controlled, and it was pretty brutal. I mean, they made no secret of the fact of what they were going to do.
John, let's flash forward. The Michigan's voters passed a ballot measure in 2018 that mm-hmm. has mandated there will be this independent commission of citizens, not partisan people who do have a party affiliation, but not people who mm-hmm. are directly connected or have served for their party. And they've asked that this be redone, as is happening right now, with the idea that communities of interest must be considered. In the language of representation, that's the work that's happening right now. In the language of representation, what are communities of interest?
Well, you think first of all to, okay, you know, protecting minority populations, but you can get into all kinds of different things. You know, are you talking about a specifically rural area, heavily agricultural? Are you talking about a specifically industrial area? We've got a lot of union workers. Are you talking about an area, for example, say Oak Park, where you have a very heavy Jewish population, as well as a very heavy Muslim population, or Dearborn, where you have a very heavy Muslim population? I mean, to a certain degree, communities of interest, there's no real hard and fast definition of it at this point. And that will, in effect, come as these things are considered.
John, there was an article in the Free Press this week speculating that while the commission is an independent citizen commission, it might still mm-hmm. be susceptible to lobbying. Having seen what you've seen, do you think that there is any way to take an aspect of lobbying in one form or another out of the redistricting process?
Well, it's interesting that piece said that, because I've been involved in some discussions with friends of mine, some of whom were very inactive with voters, not politicians, who have raised that as a major concern. And they are hopeful that commission members are being told, you know, watch yourself. You know, you go out all across the state and do these public hearings. Now, under COVID, it may be a little more difficult to do this. But if you're all sitting around at dinner, make sure nobody's actually picking up your dinner for you that you don't know about, or you know, make sure nobody's buying drinks for you or something like that. That's the concern that they have, is that you could see some subtle lobbying to try to influence how the maps will be drawn. And of course, that comes on top of the problem of not getting the full data probably in time for when the maps have to be created.
And, right. And just then you run into... for those who aren't up on this, the U.S. Census has announced that it's going to be delivering the data necessary for this work very late, like 30 days before the commission's supposed to be completely done.
Right. And you know, there is really no provision in the constitutional amendment to come up with another map if they get fresh data. There is, you know, obviously the Supreme Court could step in if need be. But there are a number of problematic situations here.
Do you think that there's still reason to be optimistic that the nonpartisan approach might have some traction, or it might have some kind of life in the future of Michigan politics?
Oh, yes, I think there is, because I think that's obviously what the majority of people wanted in voting for this. I mean, I was polled by Voters Not Politicians a year ago, and which was kind of surprised me, but okay. And one of the questions they asked, and this was one of the strangest questions I've ever been asked in a poll, was, if Voters Not Politicians was an animal, what kind of animal would it be? And I thought about it for a moment, and I said, a platypus. And they said, what? Why a platypus? I mean, I figured they'd I was going to say a French bulldog or something. and I said, well, you had no money, really, until close to the end on the campaign. You did it all on a citizen organization, which almost never happens these days. You didn't pay for petition signatures, which almost doesn't happen these days. You were able to put together a proposal that people agreed with, and you won a majority of the voters in this state. And not only a majority of all the voters, you want probably a majority of both parties. And that's just not supposed to happen. Well, here's a platypus. He's crawling on the ground. He's got duck feet, a duck bill. He lays eggs, and he has square poop. That animal isn't supposed to exist. And theoretically, neither are you. So.
John Lindstrom is a longtime journalist covering state capital politics, now retired. He was for many years the publisher of Gongwer News Service. John, thank you so much for talking with us about this.
You're more than welcome.
And that's Stateside for today. I'm April Baer. We appreciate your being here. See you Wednesday.